This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, July 10th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. KUAF and the Alma Performing Arts Center invite you to register for the Alma PAC 2013-14 season giveaway. One winner will receive two season tickets, which include performances from Nashville supergroup Time Jumpers, comedian Mark Lowry, recording artist Helen Reddy, and more. The drawing is Friday, July 19th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available at KUAF.com. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, improving access to preschool education. A grant-funded program in Bentonville will help more low-income families enroll their children in pre-K for free. Plus, jazz in the summertime. Our birdman Joe Neal finds jazz in the woods, and Robert Ginsburg, host of Shades of Jazz, has a conversation with Bob Doro, the first performer in the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series.
Also, how local communities are dealing with the permitting process for food trucks and more. But first, Arkansas House Speaker Davy Carter has been named regional president of Centennial Bank. Eric King, the marketing manager of Centennial Bank, says Carter has previously served as division president at the bank, and his familiarity with the bank and with Northeast Arkansas helped in the decision to hire the speaker.
We're excited. Davey's been part of the Centennial Bank family for a long time, and you know, his leadership skills and Davey's he's just an outstanding person, and he's an outstanding leader and banker too as well, so we're excited about this.
On June 25th, Home Bank Shares, which owns Centennial Bank, announced it was buying the privately held Liberty Bank shares of Jonesboro. King says Carter will play a crucial role in the merger, which is expected to close later this year. We'll have more later on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas has received the third highest amount of money given to a member of Congress in the first quarter of this year. A list compiled by the nonpartisan research group Center for Responsive Politics shows Pryor received just over $85,000 in the first quarter of this year. Vivica Novak, editorial director of the group, says the state's lone congressional Democrat holds some committee positions popular with lobbyists. He ranks just behind Democrats Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Max Baucus of Montana.
And then you have Mark Pryor, and right after him, at almost the same amount, Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Minority Leader from Kentucky. And both of them are running for re-election in 2014, which certainly is one reason, at least, that lobbyist money is attracted to them.
According to the center, lobbyists rank behind lawyers and law firms as top contributors to Senator Pryor since 2008. Pryor has been targeted by conservative groups nationwide who view him as one of the most vulnerable Democrats in Congress. Outside money is already being spent targeting Republican 4th District Congressman Tom Cotton, who is a possible candidate to challenge Pryor next year.
Walmart, along with 16 other retailers in North America, announced a five-year binding initiative aimed at improving safety conditions for workers at factories in Bangladesh. According to a release from Walmart, the Bangladesh Worker Safety Initiative was developed over the past 5 weeks with guidance of former U.S. Senators George Mitchell and Olympia Snow, who acted as independent facilitators of the Bipartisan Policy Center. The initiative calls for inspection of all alliance member factories within the first year, common safety standards to be developed within the next 3 months, transparency in sharing inspection results, and for alliance factories to support the democratic election and operation of worker participation committees at each factory. The initiative also provides for an independent chair of the board of directors, a chair that will be responsible for oversight of the alliance. Members of the alliance have already allocated $42 million to fund the effort, in addition to some companies offering a combined total of $100 million in loans and capital access to assist Bangladeshi factory owners in making necessary safety improvements.
Drivers in the Arkansas River Valley should be aware that road construction will cause some lane changes and closures during the next few days. Starting at midnight tonight, the on and off ramps for the southbound lanes of Interstate 540 at Grand Avenue and Fort Smith will be closed. The closure is expected to last about 3 hours so that asphalt paving of the southbound lanes can be completed. The ramp closures will be repeated from Thursday through July 19th. In addition, the Arkansas Highway Transportation Department will close one northbound lane of Highway 71 between Elmwood Cutoff and Howard Hill Road north of Greenwood. The closure will begin at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning and is expected to continue for 6 weeks as construction crews work on turn lanes and crossovers associated with the Highway 71 relocation work between Highway 71 and 22.
Changes are coming next week to payment procedures at the Inland Service Solid Waste Transfer Station in Rogers. According to the city, a current water bill or current statement from Inland Service will be required beginning July 15th to receive the city's residential rate at the transfer station that's located on North Arkansas Street.
A heat advisory is in effect for much of the listening area until 9 o'clock this evening. According to the National Weather Service, heat index values could reach as high as 105 degrees in northwest Arkansas and as high as 110 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tonight, there's a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms with lows from 70 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 76 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a slight chance of showers and highs in the 90s throughout the listening area. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with lows from 67 in northwest Arkansas to 74 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley.
Today, fewer than 3 in 10 four-year-olds are enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. Most middle-class parents can't afford a few hundred bucks a week for a private preschool. And for poor kids who need help the most, this lack of access to preschool education can shadow them for the rest of their lives. So tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America. That's something we should be able to do.
During this year's State of the Union Address, President Obama discussed the importance of all children having access to quality preschool education. Helping spread that access to more children is a new free pre-K program in the Bentonville Public School District. This fall, through their Building Bridges program, the Bentonville Public School District is opening 2 grant-funded pre-K classrooms. Administrators have 40 slots available, for free, to students who qualify. Deb Key, Early Childhood Director, says there are a number of requirements families must meet in order to participate in the program.
Well, first of all, the child has to be 3 or 4 years old by August 1st. Is the first requirement. The second requirement is income, and the income for a family of 2 cannot be more than $38,818. For a family of 3, they can't make more than $42,542, and for a family of 4, they can't make more than $48,444, and that's a family of 4 or more. The second criteria is, or the next criteria would be, they have to be working a minimum of 30 hours per week or more, or going to school full time. So the income and working is, they have to be doing both, or going to school. So income and going to school, or income and working. Because this is a program that's set up to serve working families.
Key explains the program is being funded through a Child Care and Development Block Grant the state of Arkansas received from the federal government. Key says the school district was awarded more than $194,000 to run the program for a school year. But because they want to serve working families, the program will be run year-round. So the district was awarded additional money, bringing their total to around $250,000. Key says when awarding grants, officials were looking for high-quality centers already in existence so they could start enrolling low-income families immediately and hit the ground running.
I was kind of at the right place at the right time, and I think we were probably one of the first schools in the state that just knew about the money. And since then, I let Springdale know about it, and Rogers knows about it. I know Springdale got some funding. I don't know if Rogers got funding or not, but the information is now disseminated down to a lot of different schools.
According to the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Kids Count report, from 2009 to 2011, 52% of children in Arkansas did not attend preschool. That's slightly better than the national average of 54%. The Arkansas Research Center recently conducted a study that looked at the Arkansas Better Chance Program's effect on kindergarten readiness of children. The results of that study were released in May and showed that economically disadvantaged students did better on a kindergarten entrance exam if they had been to an ABC pre-K program. In fact, they did 9 percentage points better than a child who had not been in the program. Key says a child's success in the future is one reason why it's important for more children to have access to preschool education.
There is a great need for preschool programs in Arkansas, and quality preschool programs are most important. But research does tell us that pre-K does have a meaningful impact on children. And language, literacy, and math development, those are predictive of their cognitive skills and the success that they're going to have in school as they get into elementary school. And effective preschool programs do provide early intervention. So you can catch things early on if they have special needs. Maybe they have autism or there are speech issues. Things that can be corrected early on or caught early may be corrected before they get to school. Or, you know, we can just help them before they get to school. But the things that we can do, the pre-writing, the pre-reading, the pre-math skills that we do in kindergarten can lay that foundation for future success in school.
The classrooms will have a teacher-student ratio of 1 to 10, and the new program will use the core knowledge preschool curriculum to help prepare students for kindergarten. Natasha Crosby, curriculum and technology specialist, will be working with staff to make sure the curriculum is taken care of and that teachers are integrating technology into it. Although the school district already has a preschool program in place, Crosby says the new grant-funded openings will help take care of families who oftentimes fall through the cracks.
We have families that come in that are hit on hard times and both parents are working, as most, you know, dual parent families have to do. And maybe they can't qualify for food stamps, they make too much money, or they can't qualify for vouchers, they make too much money. Their children can't get free lunches because they're not under the income, but yet they don't make enough money to really survive. And it's a common societal problem, not only just here in Bentonville, but all over our state and probably our nation as well. But that's what's, I think, most amazing for us, is that we're able to offer it to that group that typically is left out.
Early enrollment ends Friday and is on a first-come, first-served basis. Deb Key, Director of Early Childhood, says a representative from the Arkansas Department of Human Services will be on hand to qualify eligible families Monday, so participants could be notified of their acceptance as early as next Tuesday. Key says they will continue enrollment until opening day. She says priority will be given to Bentonville School District patrons, but if slots do not fill up, they will open enrollment to other in-state districts. More information is available by calling 479-254-5040 or by visiting facebook.com/Bentonville Public Schools.
Centennial Bank has named the person they want to lead the company as it merges with Liberty Bank of Jonesboro. Jonathan Reeves from our content partner KASU in Jonesboro has the details.
Arkansas House Speaker Davey Carter is the new regional president for Centennial Bank and will lead the merger between Home Bank Shares and Liberty Bank Shares of Jonesboro. The merger will create the second largest bank holding company in Arkansas with $7.1 billion in total assets. Carter says Liberty Bank brings a lot to the table.
Oh, it's the list is very long. If you've seen the footprint post-merger, you could not fit any better. Little overlap, which really is, I think, would be hard to set up that way, even if it were intentionally set up that way. We're, you know, one branch in Searcy or one layer in Searcy and Fulton. Other than that, there's very little overlap amongst the markets. It makes a perfect fit. It's just a great fit for, I think, both banks, both institutions. Not even counting all the great, the great folks and that Liberty has. Everybody's really just excited about it. It's truly historic, and our chairman referred to it as the combined banks is Arkansas's community bank, and it's got a great feel to it. We're all real excited about it.
Carter says a lot of meetings are taking place in central and northeast Arkansas about the merger. He tells what else the merger requires.
Oh, that's a lot of tedious stuff. Like any other acquisition or merger, you got to go through any other bank activity. You got to go through regulatory approval and some processes, legal processes there. Both institutions have to have shareholder votes and that sort of thing. But, that stuff is certainly very important and will be ongoing for the next some months, in addition to, everybody just getting to know each other and figuring out how we can serve the customer the very best we can. But at the end of the day, that's what it's all about.
Carter says the deals expect to be finalized this fall, pending final approval. He says the deal will create 92 bank branches in Arkansas, with a total of 151 branches and 1,500 employees in Arkansas, Florida, and southern Alabama. And Carter tells how the merger will benefit the state.
You have all of these branch opportunities, notwithstanding all of our Florida banks that we have in our home bank shares, Centennial Bank and Florida Panhandle. Of course, there's a great connection there with Arkansans and the Florida Panhandle with family vacations and such. But it just brings more accessibility and opportunities for customers, makes it easy, ATMs, bankers pretty much in every corner of the state. So from a customer standpoint, we think it's certainly beneficial for everybody.
And Carter expects business as usual as the merger continues. And he previously served as division president at Centennial Bank and also serving his third term in the State House of Representatives. Carter tells how he plans to juggle his time between Centennial Bank and the Arkansas legislature.
Oh, I'm pretty good at juggling a few things here and there. The fiscal session is relatively short. I've got a great budget chairman, great budget committee, and great chairs of the legislative council. So I'm not too worried about that. I'm a big believer in Arkansas's quote, part-time legislature, end quote. I think that's the way that the founders set it up to be, meant it to be, and I think that's what the citizens want. And we don't have to be in Little Rock 24/7 legislating to make people's lives better. That's just not the case. So it'll all be fine. I've got a great staff up there, and it shouldn't be an issue.
And that's Davey Carter, who's a graduate of Arkansas State University in Jonesboro with a bachelor's degree in finance. In addition, he holds a Juris Doctor with honors from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock's William H. Bowen School of Law and is an alumnus of the Graduate School of Banking at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. From Jonesboro, I'm Jonathan Reeves reporting.
Mary Alice may have walked away with the crown that day, but I had learned an invaluable lesson. I was not going to get by on my looks.
I was worried about the ensuing death certificate and what my final cause of death would be listed as in my obituary. Death by fishhook, death by bass boat.
After fingerprinting, they escorted us to a small cell in the back. The scene was mildly amusing. Laurel's Boys in Blue seemed more Barney Fife than Kojak.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. In Northwest Arkansas, mobile vending is being used as a type of incubator for startup businesses. As this trend has grown in recent years, communities are having to balance the economic advantage of these businesses with concerns from more traditional types of businesses. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more.
You've seen them on the downtown squares of Bentonville and Fayetteville, on Dixon Street, or even in groups on College Avenue. In the past few years, the mobile vending market has seemingly exploded with activity, most visibly in the plethora of mobile food options that have popped up at various locations. But just because these vendors set up in trailers, push carts, or food trucks doesn't mean that the businesses are fly-by-night operations. These vendors have to abide by a permitting process just like any other business. Jeremy Pate is the Director of Development Services for the City of Fayetteville. He says that while there are actually three distinct permitting processes for outdoor vending establishments in the city, the most popular one is the permit that allows mobile vendors to locate on private property.
Essentially, what we do there with our building and development codes is we review a permit application accompanied by a $50 application fee. That permit, if it is approved, is a good for 90 days at the address at which it's located. Because it is a temporary type of facility, after that 90 days in that one location within a 12-month time frame, those vendors may move to a different location and open up. Again, it has to be at least 1.5 mile away, and then they can do another 90-day period.
Which means that vendors could locate at 4 different locations in the city throughout a 12-month period. Pate says that the current ordinance also allows for vendors to have more than one mobile vending permit open at any given time, letting the vendor move to where he or she feels business is best at a given time. But some businesses who obtain a mobile vending permit aren't quite as mobile.
We have a whole grouping or a cluster of Airstream trailers down off of College Avenue and Trenton Boulevard. There's, I think, 5 of them there, and so they're not necessarily that mobile other than you can hook them up to a truck and pull them away once they're complete, but they are still considered part of our outdoor mobile vendor business.
In Bentonville, the permitting process is similar to the one that Fayetteville uses, with outdoor vendors setting up shop in that city's downtown area. Troy Galloway is the director of planning for the city of Bentonville.
Right now, I think we have 4 or 5 outdoor food vendors in and around downtown Bentonville, but we get a lot of interest, from folks that are interested in doing that, not only the outdoor food vendors, but other types of wares that could potentially be sold through sort of an outdoor vendor type setting.
Once a mobile vendor has gone through the application process, there is no time limit for them to be operating at the location listed on said permit. But Galloway says that Bentonville is attempting to make its mobile vendor ordinance and downtown area more hospitable for vendors to set up shop, making the process more straightforward and more predictable, and encouraging development of more clusters of mobile vendors in the downtown area.
There are potential benefits, outdoor vendors to downtowns that are emerging like ours is. We still have some gaps in the downtown tapestry. These sorts of outdoor vendors are very good at helping fill those gaps, at least on a temporary basis, until longer term, where we hope bricks and mortar establishments will take hold. But certainly there is a place in downtown Bentonville for outdoor vendors, and we hope to facilitate that and encourage that and do so in a manner that adds to the experience of downtown Bentonville.
But Bentonville borrowed heavily from a draft ordinance that will soon be brought before the Fayetteville City Council. Alderman Matthew Petty has been working on an update to the ordinance that governs mobile vending operations on private property.
So what we're going to do is allow any private property owner, if their property is already zoned to allow for commercial activity like retailing or opening a restaurant or that sort of thing, then we'll allow them to get a designation as a mobile vendor site. We call it a mobile vendor court. And in order to get that permit, what they'll have to do is submit a master site plan.
That master site plan would have to show how many mobile vendors would be located on the site, where the vendors would be located, as well as locations of seating, restrooms, parking, and access to utilities like electricity and wastewater disposal. Once the master plan is accepted by the city, the landowner would be issued a permit to operate a so-called mobile vendor court, much like the Fayetteville Yacht Club with its fleet of Airstream trailers on College Avenue. With his proposed ordinance, Petty says that owners of successful mobile vendor courts would eventually be required to further develop their properties.
If they're there for more than a year or even longer than that, then we're going to start requiring them to improve the property, just like we would if they'd built a building there. So when somebody comes along, they want to develop a piece of real estate and build something, we require them to do new sidewalks, new water lines, new landscaping, that sort of thing. And so we want to require commensurate improvements with mobile vendor courts because we just think fair is fair.
But some Fayetteville business owners don't think the current ordinances are fair. Last summer, a conflict arose between a mobile flavored ice stand and a nearby brick and mortar frozen custard shop on College Avenue. And just last month, a mobile chicken stand in the same vicinity drew the ire of a nearby KFC when applying for a variance to extend its 90-day permit for the location. Jeremy Pate says that while the city's planning commission tends to approve most variance requests it gets from mobile vendors asking for more time in a given location, city staff must balance a business's continued presence at its given location against other similar businesses in the vicinity.
There's a requirement passed by the city council that states that an outdoor mobile vendor's presence for an extended period of time at one location won't create an unfair advantage over similar and nearby permanent businesses. As staff, we simply can't ignore that. We have to make a finding related to that requirement. And so when we do hear from permanent businesses stating that that's the fact, and if they have any kind of data or information, you know, proximity, sales, things like that, then we certainly will listen, and we have to make a judgment call in making our recommendation.
Matthew Petty says that while some of the brick-and-mortar establishments have raised some good arguments about how mobile vendors have an upper hand, specifically regarding lower overhead and development costs, he says that some of the concerns that brick-and-mortar businesses have presented regarding mobile vendors are just unfair, considering the positive aspects that they bring to the community.
If you look at all the benefits that mobile vendors bring to the community, they're almost always locally owned and managed, which means that more of the revenue that they have stays in our community, so there's that benefit. But more than that, when you have a mobile vendor court, usually taking a piece of vacant land or a parking lot, and you're activating it with more people there. And what you end up with is tax revenue where you didn't have it before, jobs where you didn't have it before, and kind of a place where our citizens get some enjoyment out of a place that they didn't get any enjoyment before.
Troy Galloway says that Bentonville planners have been fortunate that there hasn't been an apparent direct competition between the brick-and-mortar and mobile businesses in that city's downtown area.
I think more than anything, they create an energy and draw people downtown that otherwise might not have come to downtown, because I think there are certain folks that are coming to downtown Bentonville specifically for the outdoor food vendors, and there's people that are coming downtown specifically for the bricks-and-mortar restaurants. And I think on occasions when maybe the bricks and mortar restaurants are full, some of those folks that were coming there for that were taking advantage of some of the outdoor vendors and vice versa. So I think so far it's creating a synergy that's benefiting everyone. But I can certainly see down the road where there might be some competitive issues that might arise from those arrangements.
Although Bentonville only has a handful of mobile vendors currently, and Fayetteville has several scattered throughout the city, updated regulations are probably due. Galloway says that though Bentonville has had regulations regarding mobile food operations of some sort for about 17 years, those regulations haven't always been specifically tailored to outdoor food vendors. And Matthew Petty says that the current regulations in Fayetteville were originally intended for produce stands and have been tweaked over the years to allow for mobile food trucks, trailers, and push carts. But even though the updated ordinances in the pipes for both cities borrow heavily from one another, no two cities are alike, and no two cities will need the same ordinances. At least, that's the opinion of Marcel Elizondo, a sanitary supervisor for the Travis County, Texas Health Department, the governing body that handles much of the permitting for food trucks in Austin, Texas. Since coming on board with the department in 2009, Elizondo says that he has seen an average of 1,200 to 1,300 vendor applications come through the office each year.
Not to say that this is the standard. I think it's the rules that we've come up with are rules that work for the local city government, and each city is going to be different. I mean, I had a call 2 weeks ago from Vancouver, Canada, and they have a certain way. Then, you know, a day after that, it was Lexington, Kentucky, and they had just a different way of looking at it. And like, well, that sounds good, but we're not going to go that route. We're going to try a different route, which is fine. Every city is going to have to tackle their issues, you know, whether it's a zoning issue, whether it's hours of operation, noise, trash. Every single city is going to have a different focus on what they look at.
As for new regulations for mobile vendors in Northwest Arkansas, the proposed ordinances should be brought before Bentonville and Fayetteville City Councils in the next couple of months. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
The KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series kicks off Saturday, and it seems our birdman, Joe Neal, has gotten into the spirit of things and has discovered jazz in the woods.
That's a wood thrush. are actually several wood thrushes singing at Sinking Stream Trail in Hobbs State Park. Folks who stop to listen consider the song flute-like. A song so musical has been well studied. And just so you too can be in the know, these E-Olays and other notes result from a special shrink or voice box divided into two parts. This provides lots of opportunity for improvisation around the basic E-Olay. It's jazz in the woods with flutes. Wood thrushes are the size and general body plan of our familiar robin. Their populations are robust because their habits are so well adapted to us and how we manage the land. It's opposite with wood thrushes. They have been declining since at least the 1970s. Wood thrushes spend the winter in Central America, then migrate several thousand miles north to reach Arkansas as spring becomes well advanced, around mid-April to early May. They nest in forests throughout the Ozarks. Then they head back. It's unusual to see one here as late as early October. 80 or more years ago, one observer at Winslow, deep in the Boston Mountains, stated he heard as many as 100 singing males during the peak of spring migration. That time is gone. There are still many wood thrushes in our region in the summer. You can still go out and enjoy their songs, as we did at Hobbs State Park. But there is now a lot of respectable data showing that wood thrushes require a lot of undisturbed forest in order to thrive. Of course, all disturbances are not created equal. Forests have always had disturbances. Before we came upon the scene, there were wildfires, earthquakes, windstorms, floods. But forests long ago learned to adapt and thrive in such disturbances. Forest birds evolved right along, too. However, it seems nature and her birds haven't had time to keep up with all the more recent changes. Here a list might include city sprawls, power line rights-of-way, freeways through once forest lands, and how about logging with industrial-scale equipment, and widespread application of chemical pesticides and herbicides. I am not ashamed of the society or times in which I live, or the city where I raised my daughter. But there seems to be something relatively new at play here. It may have to do with speed and scale. Whatever, wood thrush population declines invite us to keep taking a look at how we live and how we impact others, including birds. And in the meantime, and before they head south for winter, there may be a wood thrush concert near you.
Joe Neal is co-author of Arkansas Birds, published by the University of Arkansas Press. His latest book, In the Province of Birds, a Western Arkansas memoir, is published by Half Acre Press. And the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series begins Saturday with a performance by Bob Doro.
It's hard to imagine a more varied jazz career than Bob Doro's. As evidence, I offer the following. He played with Blossom Dearie, performed in an integrated army band during World War II, was commissioned to write an original Christmas song by Miles Davis, played his piano in between sets by comic Lenny Bruce, had a song covered by Mel Torme that was nominated for 2 Grammy Awards. He was musical director for a stage show starring boxer Sugar Ray Robinson, worked with avant-garde legend John Zorn, produced a record for poet Allen Ginsberg, was recruited for duets in the 1990s with Nellie Mackay, and in the 1970s produced rock and roll records for Spanky and Our Gang and counterculture band The Fugs. Oh, and he wrote this song.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction, junction.
That's Jack Sheldon singing Bob's lyrics for Conjunction, Junction. Bob Doro wrote most and sang many of the Schoolhouse Rock songs that entertained and educated millions of kids for the past 40 years. Bob Doro will kick off the 2013 KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series Saturday night at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Last week, Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz programs on Friday and Saturday nights, called Bob Doro and talked to him about a career that has included nightclubs, television, tours, and records. We'll hear some of the highlights from that conversation on today's Ozarks. Most biographies list Cherry Hill, Arkansas, as Bob Doro's birthplace, but he told Robert that his earliest memories are in the even tinier community of Crossroads Village, Arkansas. It was in Arkansas before his family moved to Texas, where Bob first sang. At age 4, in 1927, his aunt convinced him to enter an amateur contest at an Arkansas movie house.
So I entered the amateur contest, and I sang My Blue Heaven, verse and chorus, and When Polly Was a Little Girl, which I guess I learned in school.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe your first breakout tune, Devil May Care, was originally recorded by the American swing jazz bandleader, trumpeter, and a fellow Texan, Les Elgart. Is that
right? That's right.
Well, how did he get exposure to your writing and to your music?
Well, I never met Les. I met his arrangers, and one was his son, Larry Elgart, and one was Charles Albertine. But there was a vocalist, a sort of a Frank Sinatra type cat, who sang with the band. His name was Don Forbes, and one of my Texas pals had contacts. Maybe he had played saxophone in the saxophone section. But anyway, he gave Devil May Care to Don Forbes. So Don Forbes started singing it on their jobs, and eventually, I guess, the two arrangers wrote it up for him. And then they called one day and said, we want to record your song. And I wrote it with a neighbor, a guy that lived in the same apartment building in New York, and so we went down and signed the contract, and we didn't read the fine print, but we were so excited. I didn't know much about the music business per se at that time, since I didn't have jazz education. But you know, I let them. They said, "We want to publish it." Okay, are you publishing it? No. I think you can publish it. So we signed up, and you know, for 28 years they owned the song, and they never paid any statements or anything, and I wasn't hip enough to sue them or anything like
that. Oh, man.
However, the U.S. copyright law enabled me to take it away from them in 28 years later, which would have been about 71, I guess.
No cares for me. I'm happy as I can be. I learned to love and to live. Devil may care. No cares or woes, whatever comes later goes. That's how I'll take and I'll give. Devil may care. When the day is through, I suffer no regrets.
You alluded to your sojourn out to the West Coast in the late 50s. You spent some time out there, and this is where you first met Miles Davis, wasn't it?
Yeah, I sort of got stranded in L.A. and started working, and Lenny Bruce helped me get a cabaret job, and then I got in a hot quintet where they needed a new piano player, and that was fun, a standard tenor sax and trumpet quintet. So I was living a double life of the cabaret singing and the bebop that we played with the Jazz Savoys And I wound up living in L.A. 3 years and sort of liked it, and it was a hot time. I met Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman and Paul Bley and Carla Bley and all the band from Ornette's quartet before they went to New York, before they made it big, mostly at jam sessions. And I had a few New Yorker friends who had moved to L.A. before me. And, of course, I'd heard Miles many times in New York, but you couldn't get close to him. You know, he'd sort of ignore you if you said, "Hey, Miles, that was a great set, man." He'd just walk on by, you know, wouldn't even say thanks or anything. But in L.A., we had a mutual friend. She was a jazz singer from Philly, and she used to know everybody because she was in this smaller city. So everybody that played the jazz club in Philadelphia usually met Terry Morrell. She admired the beboppers and the heavy hitters like that. So Miles, it seemed he liked to stay in someone's apartment if he could rather than a hotel. I don't know why. Just more informal, I guess, and less visible. Anyway, he was living in her landlady's home in Laurel Canyon, and she lived in the attic, and he'd come up in the afternoon, and my LP, the one with me in the orange Target there, was always prominently displayed on her shelves. And
that's the Devil May Care recording.
Yeah, one day he said, "What's that?" She said, "That's my pal, Bob. He writes songs and plays piano and sings. Let me hear it." And so she told me a day or two later that Miles had listened. She said to my whole LP, I find it hard to believe, but when she said that, I said, "Let's go to the gig." I don't think I was even going to go. He was on a 3-week engagement at a jazz club with Coltrane and Cannonball and Paul Chambers and Jimmy Cobb and I think Wynton Kelly.
Ooh, how could you not go to that gig, Bob?
Well, I'd heard so much of him in New York, and, you know, it costs money.
Right.
I wasn't known around the jazz club where I'd have to pay $10 or $15 to get in.
I see.
But when she said that, I said, "We're going tonight." So there she caught him off the bandstand while the cats were still finishing up a tune. You know how he was. He'd leave the stand after he played his choruses. Anyway, she said, "Miles, this is my friend I was telling you about." So he walked over to me, and instead of saying, "Pleased to meet you, loved your LP," or anything like that, he grabbed me by the wrist and whispered in my ear, "Bob, go up and sing Baltimore Oriole."
At the gig?
He drug me up there.
Baltimore Oriole. She took a look at the mercury one day. Well, it was 40 below. No time for a lady to be dragging her feathers around in the snow. Leaving her mate, straight she flew to the Tangipaho, where a two-timing jaybird met the divine Miss O.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your, can I call it your parallel career and and your accomplishments with the younger generation. I'm referring, of course, to the music and the lyrics and your involvement in the animated children's series Schoolhouse Rock.
Yeah, well, you know, in the 60s after I got back from L.A., and so I recorded with Miles, but I wasn't getting much work. You know, I'd go to an agent, and he'd say, "You got a group?" And I'd say, "Sure, I got a group, bass and drums and saxophone if you want or something." He said, no, I mean, you know, like the Beatles, like the Monkees, like the Rolling Stones, a group, you know, singing group. And I said, "Oh, no. Ben Tucker was my pal. We had worked together in L.A., bass and piano, and he was in New York, too, and he got a hit song called Coming Home, Baby, and with Herbie Mann at Newport.
Right, right.
And he asked me to write lyrics, and I did, and we wound up getting a Mel Torme recording of Coming Home, Baby. And it's one of my most recorded songs, actually. And And I don't know, George Newell was an executive at the ad agency, and his boss, his president, had told him, do you know anyone that could put the, I'm trying to get someone to put the multiplication tables, because my little boys can't memorize their times tables even, but yet they sing along with Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones. And George said, well, I'll find someone. So he asked Ben one night at the Hickory House, where Ben was playing with Billy Taylor, who was admired greatly by George Newell, who actually, even though he was a great advertising writer, had majored in music at Florida State and could play the piano and loved jazz. So he was always going out to hear it. And he got Ben, and Ben said, Bob Dura, you can put anything to music. So anyway, I was called to a meeting, and suddenly I became, well, the first song I wrote knocked them off their feet. Three is a magic number.
Oh, my goodness.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number.
Bob Dura will perform Saturday night at Walton Arts Center as the first concert in the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. Tickets and more information are available at KUAF.com. For a digest of all things jazz, including the rest of the 15th Annual Concert Series, you can go to digjazz.com. Bob talked with Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz on KUAF, each Friday and Saturday night at 10 o'clock.
Yes, they did. They had three in the family. That's a magic number.
3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30.
3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a new book blends Star Wars and Shakespeare. Wonder what he'd think about that.
He'd say you're no Shakespeare, but I do think he would enjoy it. Shakespeare had a great sense of humor, and I think would have enjoyed sort of the spirit behind this book.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF.
And this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Yesterday, we asked two questions related to fireflies.
We did.
Inspired by the Firefly Fling Festival that's going to take place at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks on Saturday night.
Yes.
And on Friday's show, I'm going to talk to a fire spinner that's performing there.
Fun.
But the questions asked, one for the left brain, one for the right brain.
So one scientific, one a little more creative.
Right.
Okay.
Left brain, I asked, what's the difference between the nocturnal species of fireflies and the diurnal, those that sleep at night? Many people got the right answer, which is?
Well, one has a light and one does not.
Right. I mean, the ones in the daytime don't light up.
Right.
Garrett Brewer was selected out of the ceramic cow. And so Garrett got the right side, or the left side question.
Congratulations.
Correct. And he'll get the family pack for the four tickets to Malco Movie Theater and the four vouchers to any Northwest Arkansas Naturals home game, as long as it's not sold out.
Mm-hmm.
Garrett will be back in touch so we can get your address and mail them to you. Now, the right side.
Yes.
We asked for a collective noun for fireflies.
I was very excited about this one, actually. We got some very creative answers.
So, by my research in the middle of the night when I had insomnia, there were no official collective noun, like pride of lions or pack of wolves. So, we asked you to give us some suggestions, and we had some great ones.
We had some really good ones. We had Glow popped up a bunch.
Yes.
Flash Mob was fun.
I like that.
Glimmer and Torch. Fire Fleet, I thought, was very creative as well.
A fire fleet of fireflies. It's hard to say, but I like it.
It's fun. Glitter, Illumination, Lantern was fun.
Yes.
Twinkle. Swarm, as you tell me, was written with warm being capitalized.
Yes. Three lowercase s's, then warm, so it's swarm, but warm.
Because it's in the summertime.
Yeah, I thought that was very creative.
Flicker and a luminescence, so lots of good suggestions, thanks to everybody that participated.
But we needed an impartial judge who didn't see the names attached to pick the winner.
Right.
So we go to the Phoenix metro area in Arizona. Hello.
Hello.
Ithi Agnihotri Madolkar is with us. She is our judge.
I know. It's been a while. How are you?
Doing very well.
Are there fireflies in Arizona?
Probably. If the summer would allow me to go out at night, I would probably see some fireflies, but it's been pretty much not doable.
What are your highs? What have your highs been out there?
It was about 120 degrees 2 weeks ago, and it's been 115 since then. So
cool front.
Yes, very cool.
All right, so earlier this morning, Ithi, I sent you the list of all of the suggestions from all of our listeners who participated, and you have picked a winner.
Yes, I have. And to all the listeners, this is just my choice. It's because honestly, the choices were so good. Like, there was not one that I was like, can I pick this one? Can we have like three winners? Can we please do this? But I chose Flicker.
Flicker.
A flicker of fireflies.
I like it.
Because I looked up the meaning, and it was, I knew the meaning, but I just looked it up just to be, really sure that I was doing the right thing. And so it said unsteady burning, and it just sounded so poetic. So I was like, maybe I'll just go with this one.
That is Ithi Agnihotri Madolkar to a T right there.
No, I said yesterday, he's like, who can we get to be an impartial judge? And I said, this totally sounds like an Ithi thing. This is a conversation we would sit around having.
Yes. I am so glad that you have that conversation.
Well, Paige Burkham, congratulations. Flicker was Paige's contribution, so she gets four tickets to the theater, to any Malco movie theater, and four vouchers to see a Northwest Arkansas Naturals baseball game at Arvest.
So congratulations to both of our winners.
Ithi, thank you so very much.
Thank you for thinking of me.
Of course.
All right. Have a pleasant day and stay cool.
You too.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. KUAF is supported by Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. These daily newspapers offer local, state, and national and international news, plus business and Razorback news. NWAOnline.com for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Staymore.
Remind me again, Staymore?
Staymore.
I thought Staymore wasn't real.
Well, no.
Okay.
But it sprang from the imagination of Donald Harrington. Most of his books were centered in the fictional Newton County community of Staymore. One of his earliest books was Lightning Bug, which is another name for Firefly.
But Staymore is still a fictional place. Correct?
Depending on how much you like Donald Harrington's books, I'll contend that there is a Staymore somewhere. Yes, it's fictional.
But I mean, if I was to pull up a map of Arkansas, I can't find a Staymore in our listening area.
No, but I have a map on my wall, the Reader's Map of Arkansas, which was a thing done 19 years ago.
That you came up with on your own?
I did not.
And
no,
made
no,
stuff
no. C.D. Wright, the poet, the Arkansas native and poet, she teaches at Brown University, I believe, did this project about all the writers that had come from Arkansas. And there's a map that comes with it. So like C.D. Wright came from Mountain Home originally. Mountain Home's on there. Little Rock and Fayetteville for people like Donald Harrington. But Staymore is on that map.
Okay.
So I can find you a map of Arkansas.
That has it on there.
Yes.
Were we talking about this the other day? Aren't they doing a documentary on him?
They are. I want to do a story about that.
Okay.
Because,
I think it's still
know,
in production and stuff and people are still working on it. Subtitles and things. But I do know you are a fan. So.
Yes.
Oh, quick recommendation I have for you. Have you seen Sleepwalking with Me? It's a movie with Mike Birbiglia, the comedian, and I think it was in production. It had something to do with This American Life as well.
Yeah. No, I have not seen that.
Watched it last night, and I liked it.
All right.
Just FYI.
Have you seen Mud yet?
No, I was going to go see it.
I would recommend that.
And it was out of theater, so I'll have to wait for a DVD now.
Okay. Well, it's very well done. It's beautifully shot.
Okay.
Shot in Central Arkansas.
Well, thank you. I will add that to my list of many movies I need to see.
Okay.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Well, you'll be back tomorrow with Christina.
That's correct.
Have a happy Wednesday.